Hello everybody, and welcome to the session titled Big, Fast, and Data Furious with Spark. I'm Maxim Lukyanov, Program Manager on Big Data team at Microsoft. I work on R Server and Spark in Azure HD Insight Service. Yesterday I had a session on R Server, and some of you after the session, in our discussion after the session, expressed the frustration that you said, hey, I'm a data scientist and I love machine learning and data modeling, but in practice, I'm stuck at actually preparing my raw data, making it ready for data modeling. So in this session today, we'll talk about Spark, and hopefully this session will help get you unstuck in situations like that. In this session, we'll talk about tools and techniques that you can use to make yourself productive or keep your productivity high while you're working on big data. This will be a demo-rich session, and after demos, hopefully we'll have time for extra topic where we'll talk about some aspects of the resource management that applies to these interactive Spark environments that we're going to talk about. Another comment here is that almost all of the things that, almost all of the components that we are going to talk about are 100% open source. So that means that while the session will be focused on Azure environment, specifically on HD Insight Service, you can potentially use all of these techniques and set up environments like we will discuss in your on-premises environments or in any other environments. So you can take these learnings with you and apply across your career. Okay, with that, let's get started. So at Microsoft, we are privileged to work with many enterprise customers. And in one of the most structured customer studies, we had opportunity to talk to three groups of customers, about 10 to 20 customers each. And we asked them this question, what is your top concern for big data projects? And we get a variety of responses, and we can even sample these responses that we get in this audience. So if you have some specific answer to this question, just shout it loud and I will repeat it for everybody. So any ideas? What is your top frustration with big data projects?
Quality of data.
Getting it in and transforming it. Couple more.
Processing time.
Okay, that's good. So we asked this question to our customers, and we also gave them opportunity to kind of discuss what ideas or problems they raised and vote across all of this set of problems of which one is the most common one. And I'm happy to share this insight with you today that we gathered from this discussion, because the answer that we get, the number one common problem that has surfaced to the top was length of development cycle. And that's not absolutely obvious thing to say, but apparently it was something that generated consensus across our customers. So length of development cycle. So there are three things that I would like to highlight about that. The first, this is not just a problem statement. It is actually ready to use metric. And as a metric, we can start to track it and improve it. So that's for managers and project managers among you, that's an actionable thing to move forward with, so that's great. The second thing is it actually all but defines productivity. And to make this point, let me give you kind of a scenario. Imagine you are a data scientist, imagine a day of data scientist, and you want to make progress on some project, on some problem. In the simplistic terms, that would probably translate into some sequence of experiments. You would make an experiment, you make a conclusion, that would drive towards next experiment. But the question here is, what would be your maximum speed with which you can proceed with this project? It's probably a speed of thought. As much as you can basically move forward. The moment you make a conclusion about the first experiment, you're ready to move forward with the next experiment. But not if you're actually waiting for your big data job to complete. In this case, your productivity is limited by the speed of this each iteration. In other words, you can no longer work with the speed of thought. You now work with the speed of whatever big data job you're waiting on. And that actually affects your productivity significantly. In a relative terms, your productivity drops very low compared to its kind of optimal value. So from that point of view, productivity is all but determined, especially in the big data world, in how you organize your iterations and how fast you can do your development cycle. And the third thing that is interesting about this problem statement is that it actually is a very strong predictor of the project risk. And that is a fairly well-known statement. If your project has long development cycle, then it's probably risky, and this is how it works. Again, any project is probably done on some deadline, or we need to project amount of resources that we need to invest into this project to complete it. But every time we do this, we actually need some assurance that project will complete in the amount of time that we predict. But if your development cycle is long, we all know that no project is going to go as planned. There is always something unexpected that happens in the project. And when this happens, it basically adds some random number of iterations of the dev cycle to a project timeline. And if you add 100 of project iterations, development cycle iterations, each one of which takes hours, then suddenly you're talking about weeks of added time. And at that point, it becomes impossible to predict when your project is going to complete, which makes it almost impossible to actually succeed with any project that has long development time cycles. So length of development cycles is important. So let's proceed forward to see how we can make sure that length of development cycle is kept low when we work with big data in Spark environments. So first of all, while we are talking about development cycle, it actually consists of several phases. And throughout the presentation, we'll talk about how you can keep yourself productive and under control your dev cycle in all of these phases. First, before you can start developing something, you need to actually have opportunity to explore data in a very rapid way and kind of make conclusions, understand it, and then maybe share this data with your team. And this act of sharing should also be very efficient and shouldn't take long time, otherwise it will block progress on your project. And of course, once you are ready to start building your production artifacts, your development environment should be on rails and should be efficient as well. And finally, when you have your product or first version of your code working in a production more-like environment on the real data sets, you'll face a final set of problems where you'll have bugs and problems in production, and you need to have, again, be able to efficiently debug and fix problems. So all of these four phases are important for our productivity. So first, let's take a look at the overall picture of all of the components that we are going to talk about. So that's maybe a little complex picture, but in the following parts of the presentation, we'll discuss every component specifically. So starting from left, you can see here Jupyter notebooks that represent our answer to the data exploration manipulation tool. So we'll talk about Jupyter notebooks. Jupyter notebooks in this environment that we are going to discuss are connected to a Livy server, which is a job server for Spark that we collaborated with Cloudera and Hortonworks to make enterprise ready, and we deliver it as part of the Edge Insight service. This is an open source component, so you can use it as well. Second tool that we are going to talk about is as a tool that allows you to share data with your team or with outside of your organization. So that would be a set of BI tools. We'll talk about Power BI. You can also connect Tableau here. And in terms of Spark cluster architecture, this requirement or this scenario is accommodated by a component called Thrift Server. So that's a Spark Thrift Server. It's also open source component that allows ODBC clients to connect to the cluster and execute some SQL queries. And finally, development environments provided for Scala Vault through IntelliJ and Eclipse products. And we have plugins for this environment that connect them seamlessly to AG Insight service, again, through Livy server. All of these endpoints that accommodate all these use cases and scenarios are able to share resources with each other, so you are not locked into only one of them through usage of Yarn Resource Manager. So all of these resources can operate on the cluster at the same time, and if you have time for this session, we'll discuss what the implications of resource management here and what the current problems and solutions that exist. Okay, so let's start discussion about the components. So the first important component is the heart of this whole thing is the Spark itself. So how many of you are familiar with Spark? Please raise your hand if you're familiar with it. Okay, about 40-50%. So we'll spend not much time here then. You're already familiar with that. But what's important to emphasize is that Spark in the recent time became kind of a new kind of hot topic in the big data area. And there are many reasons behind it, but one of the few attractors that are important for the discussion today is that it was designed as an interactive big data engine from the get-go, as opposed to Hadoop that was designed as a send a batch of jobs and wait for it to complete. So Spark from the beginning had this opportunity to where you launch a Spark shell, and whenever command you type in, if it doesn't involve processing of large amounts of data, it will try to return to you in an interactive time immediately. So Spark on the small data sets is interactive by default. It also is a big data tool, so it has abilities to actually run in a fairly interactive manner on a large data sets as well. And through its in-memory architecture, it actually allows you and gives you tools to process large data sets in an interactive manner too. So we'll discuss that capabilities as well. And last, but probably the most important piece of Spark from its core is a built-in functionality in Spark that allows you to do sampling of data very easily. And that's a small function maybe in Spark that's frequently overlooked, but it's actually a key for our productivity when we are working with big data assets. And we'll talk much more about that subsequently. Spark is also not staying in place. There is a great focus in the community on improving Spark performance, and Spark 2.0 comes with a final set of features as part of the Project Tungsten, where it uses enhanced in-memory optimizations and code generation practices to further improve speed with which it can produce computations. So next part of the solution is actually a cloud, or how we host Spark in Azure cloud. So a couple of words about that. So in HD Insight, what we get is basically best bits of Spark and corresponding Hadoop components that are available out there in an enterprise-ready manner. So to accomplish that, we partner with Hortonworks to get a stable distribution of this open source bits. And we stay behind these bits. We provide full supportability for you and also manageability. So the Spark clusters that you can get as part of the HD Insight service are called managed clusters. And that means that first, it's very easy to provision one. So in a few clicks or with the help of a small script, if you want to automate it, you can provision fully functional Spark cluster with all of the components that we are going to talk about today in the cloud. And also, all the bits and components that you get with this cluster are fully supported by Microsoft. Their components are also configured in a highly available configuration, which is requirement for to call this configuration enterprise ready. And there is also a set of certifications that confirm and cloud SLAs that confirm that statement. Another set of features that we deliver in the Azure cloud on top of Spark is set of productivity tools like connectivity to BI, connectivity to integrated development environments. Again, we'll talk about it in next slides as well. So now we can start our demo part and talk about the rest of the components in the context of actually seeing them in action. Let me wake up my demo machine first.
I have a
question. Sure, go ahead.
You said 2.0
is
coming later, but it's
going to
be ready in a winter.
Oh, you noticed?
Yeah, I was going to ask you more.
Yeah, so Spark 2.0, that's a hot topic again. So first of all, Spark 2.0 is available even today to be installed on HDNSSET cluster through help of a little script action. But later this week, I believe on Thursday, we'll actually announce built-in support for Spark 2.0. So as part of your cluster creation workflow, you'll be able just to specify Spark 2.0 and provision it in HDNSSET. We'll also deliver it with about 100 stability fixes because that's the feedback we get from customers. Spark 2.0 right now is kind of not very stable. So with the help of these stability fixes, we'll deliver you a solution that you can hopefully start using in production. Okay, so demo. And we just talked about Spark 2.0. So HDNSSET clusters in Azure portal, so that's Azure portal. HDNSSET clusters is where you'll find the things that we are talking about, and the managed aspect of our clusters means that you can simply click a button, add button, and create a Spark cluster. So let's not spend too much time on this, but to give you context, so this is how it looks like. You select a type of the cluster, you select a version, and 2.0 will become available later this week. And then you select standard cluster type if you want just to use Spark, or you can upgrade your experience to include RServer as well if you want that. So once you selected Spark cluster type, you fill in all of the other items in this dialog, including selecting your VM types, and you can create a cluster. So in the interest of time, I already pre-created a cluster. So let's find an existing one. And once you created a cluster, you can see a variety of components and services that are provisioned with this cluster available in this management pane. So we can say cluster dashboards, and here we can see various services available on the cluster, including Jupyter Notebooks. So let's start with them. So Jupyter Notebooks is one of the kind of primary experiences for data exploration in an interactive manner. One of the notebooks here that I have is Scala Notebook. So I have it opened here. The Scala Notebook actually describes a set of features that we have developed as part of our customization of the Jupyter project. So Jupyter, that's a Python-based, web-based in notebooks. And originally, Jupyter project didn't have Spark integration. So we added the Spark integration, and if you scroll back a little bit, this is how it looks like. So in a Jupyter project, there is an extensibility model based on so-called kernels. So the kernel is an interpreter that would drive what happens inside of the notebook when you execute code. So alongside these descriptions and pictures, in a notebook, you can have also cells that allow you to type code. And that is where we integrated Spark, so we can type Spark code. So going back to this kernel that we have developed for Spark, it's called Spark Magic, and it's, again, also open source component. We open sourced it, so you can download it from this link and use it. And it interacts with the Livy server, which is a job server, to send your cell statements to Spark, execute it in Spark, and return back results. So basically, it supports a notion of the interactive session, where you can start an interactive session and go through the steps of the command and see the results back. And the important piece in this architecture is that we configure it in a way that it works through a Livy job submission service, which allows us to share resources with all of the other workloads that you might want to run on the cluster. One of the features that we added to a Livy job submission service itself is related to enterprise readiness. So we added a high availability feature. So this notion of the interactive session that Livy has originally disappeared or was lost if Livy service itself would shut down or restart, and that frequently happens in cloud environments. So we added a feature where it actually stores this session state in a Zookeeper ensemble, which is part of our HD Insight clusters. And whenever it restarts, it actually can recover this interactive session that allows your notebook or jobs submitted to Livy to continue without interruption. That's important for your production pipelines. So a few things about the actual Jupyter kernel for Spark that we added. First, this integration or extensibility of Jupyter is usually done through the, another concept called MAGIC. And what MAGIC stands for is basically a custom command that starts with two percentage signs. So that's a Jupyter notation for extensibility points. So we added several MAGICs here. So first one is an info MAGIC that allows you to list all of the available Spark sessions that are running on your cluster. And the start button here that you can see means that the command is actually being executed. And the fact that it's taking so long means that something is not absolutely right. Okay, let me try again. Okay, so now it's working. It needed to reconnect. So you can see a set of old sessions that are already dead, and a couple of sessions for the current notebook and for the another one that I'll show in a minute here existing. So what is important here from the point of view of interactive Spark is whenever you debug something with your code that you run in the notebook, you need to have access to the Spark UI. So we make it easy for you to just click on this link and open Spark UI to see what jobs you are running, or to see executor logs, or if you need to access driver logs, you can also easily go to the driver logs as well. So that's a very nice feature for the debuggability of your notebooks on Spark. On the side of the data exploration, what we have added is also ability to support inline SQL inside of the Jupyter notebook. So you can, for Hive tables that you have in your Spark cluster, you can basically specify the SQL query here with the help of the SQL magic and see in automatic visualization done for you here. Let's build a bar chart. And you can specify what type of chart you want to see, and then you can see the chart here. So that allows you to jump from kind of a raw data assets to running SQL queries over them, to immediately visualizing them in a very interactive, rapid manner. And just to go quickly, if you're limited in terms of visualizations that are available with this automatic widget, we also provide ability for you to use any of the visualization libraries that are available in the Python community, and that's a very large number, through this magic called local. So in this local magic, you can basically use any Python library to visualize your data. For example, this little script, whenever it works, renders a state map based on your data. So that's a very nice kind of set of features that come from the Python community that you can leverage in your notebooks to kind of build very rich and powerful visualizations on your data inside of the notebook. Okay, moving on. So the next notebook that I wanted to show you is based on the New York dataset. So that's that one. Let's open it here. And the New York data set is a good example to use to show kind of a difference between interactive and non-interactive data exploration, because it's a fairly large one. It's not like huge, but it's 180 gigabytes, and it has about 1 billion of rows. So it's very easy to actually become slow in exploration of this data set. So what techniques can we use to make sure that whenever we do something with the data, we never wait for Spark to complete? So the first technique is, hey, let's use the natural power of Spark to be interactive. And we can do that with the help of restricting data. So first, whenever we work with data, we can use this limit keyword to say, hey, just give me a subset of data, this small sample. And in this example, you can see that I'm reading some data set from the data lake store from some location. And this data set is actually 180 gigabytes. And I encoded it in JSON. So that is actually pretty significant work to be done by Spark if I'm to process the whole thing. But because I'm just looking at the head of the data, you see that I need just a few seconds to actually take a look what's in the beginning. So that's the first kind of step that you can do to keep yourself productive. And here we can see that, oh, it is indeed some JSON data. So what can we do with JSON data? Spark supports automatic inference of schema of the data for JSON documents. So that makes it very easy for us to grab some random JSON document and start exploring it in the form of the table. Unfortunately, Spark also requires quite a long time to infer JSON schema on the 180 gigabyte document. So this is a little trick here that you can say, hey, Spark, don't try to scan this whole 180 gigabytes of data to infer the schema. Just scan this little header of this data, because I know that my data is consistent across the thing. So if you use that approach, then we can fairly quickly register this JSON dataset as a table in Spark. And you see, again, it completed in a few seconds. So now we have this row taxi table, temporary table created for us that maps into a JSON dataset. And again, we can start exploring it using SQL commands. And that gives us a pretty good kind of ability to start manipulating this data, understand it. So let's assume that we did some exploration of the data using SQL commands, and now we are ready to say, hey, this is exactly the subset of data that I need to send for my data modeling step. So that would look like a command that looks like something like that. It says that, hey, drop a bunch of columns from this data set because I don't need them, then filter out some noise from the data that I don't need at the moment. And the resultant cleaned up data set save as a new table. So I already did this step. In order to process the whole data set, it may take some time. So it's a kind of a one final operation that you want to don't want to execute too frequently. But once you did that, you're ready to start working with this data and start doing feature exploration, kind of the next steps in your data science process. And this is where the actual kind of decision point lies. Because once you have this cleaned up data set, it is kind of tempting to continue working with this full thing. And especially given the Spark has built-in capabilities to kind of speed up your processing of this big data. So the first choice that you can make is say, hey, let me save this cleaned up data set in some fast data format. And it is indeed fast. You can use ORC or Parquet to kind of compress your data in the columnar format. And that would indeed improve the performance with which you can process this data. But if you continue kind of using this full data set on an ongoing basis, you'll, with all the optimizations that Spark provides, you would still be looking at very long times for your jobs. So that is basically a big data trap that you can fall into if you continue working with your full data set. The answer to that is use sampling. And Spark provides this great simple function where you can take a sample and you can, if you make it a discipline to actually always work with sample in an interactive manner and only kind of run your jobs on a full data set occasionally and keeping that under control. Then you can control your destiny, basically. So sampling is a great technique. And in this case, we take a sample of that data set, which would be just 35 megabytes. And we can even cache this sample to make sure that it's as fast as possible. And once we did this, we can start further experimenting with this data. And this experimentation will actually be interactive. So let's look at the distribution of passenger counts in this data set. So in a few seconds, we can take a look at the distribution. And now we know that, hey, a majority of this data set is this one passenger, and there's few reducing number of passengers with two and three. So that's great. But there is a problem with sampling. So sampling is not the universal kind of thing. Sometimes it misses the data, and sometimes you need to actually go back to a full data set to double check that the conclusions that you made based on the samples are actually valid. So how do you do this? So this is where you can go back to the working with the full data set. And again, Spark provides you tools to make sure that steps are productive. So what you can do here is to make sure that when you need to go back to the full data set, it still works fast. You can use caching as a first mechanism. But caching large data sets in memory of your cluster, while certainly makes operations faster, requires a lot of memory. So how you can do that? So this is where cloud as an elastic thing in the cloud helps. So whenever you need to go back to work with the full data set, you actually can go back to your Azure Edge Insight cluster and say, hey, at this moment, I'm going to do something big on this cluster. So scale it up dynamically because I need this. So you can say, from 10 nodes that we currently have, which is already big because I wanted to show this caching data set working, you can scale up to 100, or if you had it at the one node, you can scale it up to 10 nodes. So once you did this scaling operation, you can now cache the data set, and once you cached it, you can remain kind of reasonably interactive as well. So for example, now we can count the number of records and we can see that it has billion of records in it. And we can repeat this query that we ran on the sample on a full data set to double check that our conclusions that we drawn based on the sample are still valid for the full data set as well. So that will take a little longer because we are now working with a full data set. But it allows us to confirm that now the shape of the distribution that we saw on the sample matches the one that we see on the full data set. But the totals you can see actually now represent the total total sizes. So that's kind of a two primary techniques that you can use. Once you did this, you can proceed forward to with your data science process and actually make further operations like feature extraction and things like that. And if you keep your operations on the sample like we have in this case, all of these operations will be interactive, like taking a histogram and then charting it using the Python libraries is interactive. And you can proceed of making sense of this data. For example, hey, what is the tip amount by fair amount distribution, and you can start looking at it and determine that, hey, there is some trends and patterns in this data that I can take advantage of or design some new features that better express these things that I see in the data. So you can start working with the data and keep yourself interactive. And once you've done this, you can run the jobs that actually move you towards data modeling. So let's move quickly through them for the sake of time. For example, you can apply some binning technique here, and I put some time in here so you can see that all of those operations were interactive. You can apply some additional encoding to featureize your data. And finally, you can start defining your, in this case, a regression model. So you can split into train test data sets and build, boosting trees regression model that predicts tip amount. So let's scroll through that one. So the building a prediction model on the boosting trees because of the sampled small data set is again still remains kind of interactive. And finally, we can look at the resultant predictions which try to predict tip amount based on the number of passengers in the car. So that's kind of a first level of data exploration. So how do you proceed forward to data sharing? So in Spark, we have this connectivity for BI tools. And it's fairly easy to connect Power BI, for example, to Spark cluster image inside. You can also use Tableau if you prefer. So you would go into Power BI, you would say get data, and in the list of databases, Power BI has first class support for Spark clusters on Agent Insight. Again, it just needs some time to refresh its data. Okay, so now we have Spark here. And in order to connect to Spark, all you need is just URL of the cluster and credentials for the cluster. So in the interest of time, while it's importing data, let's look at the dashboard that I have already created. So it takes a few minutes to set up this dashboard, but you can get your wonderful rendering of the passenger count distribution and send a URL to this Power BI dashboard to your team and share this kind of insights with them. And you can have a variety of other chart types, including some custom visualizations that Power BI supports. So things like that. So that covers the angle of the sharing of your data. And a couple of other important capabilities include developing of your production artifact. So for that, we have implemented a plugin for IntelliJ IDEA and for Eclipse, and using this plugin, you can submit your Spark job. So here's a simple sample job to HD Insight cluster. So you just use submit to HD Insight, and here you can select your cluster type, your cluster. So it lists all of the clusters available in your Azure subscription. You submit, you select the class name that you want to execute, and you just click submit. So it's fully integrated kind of ability to interact with your HD Insight cluster from within IntelliJ IDEA. While it's executing, and we also support a very cool feature where you can actually debug your jobs on a remote cluster. We don't have much time, but the way it looks like is you can connect your machine to the virtual network through the virtual network to your cluster, and that enables your machine to kind of see all of the nodes of the cluster. And that allows you to use Yarn client mode to start a job from your local machine that would execute on the cluster. So yeah, we don't have time for that, but it looks like that. You would connect your virtual network, your machine to a virtual network. So our previous job succeeded, so that's great. So now let's proceed forward with a debugging example. So if we press debug, hopefully our breakpoint that we have here hits. Let's see. Okay, so something didn't work out. Request Spark driver. Okay, let's give it another try. In the logs, you can see how Spark, that is running from the IntelliJ IDEA, connects to the resource manager on the cluster and kind of creates a yarn application on the cluster. So now it's in accepted state. And then kind of launches the application. Useful here is that the driver code of your Spark application is actually running as part of your IntelliJ process. And that allows it to kind of hit all of the breakpoints that you specified in there. Okay, so we're stuck in the accepted state. Probably one of the notebooks that we launched doesn't allow us to finish. So let's close and halt here. Okay, so it's 11 minutes. Okay, while it's proceeding, let's move to the next part of our session. Okay, we'll come back here to see if it succeeded to create a yarn application. But for now, let's move back to the slide deck. So resource management, as you saw in this example, we can run both BI kind of workload to render your charts inside of the Power BI, as well as notebooks, and even run some jobs on the side from IntelliJ IDEA. So all of that is possible to happen at the same time, and that's made possible through a use of Yarn Resource Manager. So how this kind of resource sharing is managed? So it's in Yarn, there is a notion of queues which can be used to manage resources. And one of the requirements that we would have here is if you're running your Thrift server occasionally, so if you're running your Power BI reports from time to time when you want to refresh them, you don't want your Thrift server to hold on to some resources in your cluster. You want all of the resources by default to be available for your notebooks or for some Spark jobs that you're running. So how you can accomplish that? So we configured Thrift server with a dynamic resource allocation. So that's one of the techniques that you can use, which means that by default, Thrift server doesn't use any resources on your cluster, and only when it receives actual SQL request, it will dynamically request additional containers in Yarn to start executing these queries. And even if the cluster is completely utilized by a notebook or by some other Yarn job, through a use of resource preemption, Thrift server can actually request resources from those other applications and reduce amount of resources that they consume dynamically to execute the SQL queries. There is a couple of bugs that you can take a look later in the slide deck that we had to fix and work around with the Yarn Resource Manager, like we had to use Capacity Resource Scheduler instead of Dominant Resource Calculator. But we can skip that. So in summary, we talked through the several components and techniques that you can use to kind of make sure that you're keeping your productivity high while working with Spark in big data. At this point in time, big data big data in Spark is still remains in the state where it's kind of a sharp tool. And it's really easy to kind of overindulge in all of these parquet formats and work with a full data sets too much. And in this case, you would be kind of falling in this trap of the big data. So a primary kind of takeaway of this session is if you set up your environment correctly, then use the sampling and caching techniques correctly to make sure that you're productive while working with big data. Okay, and there are a few related links. So the New York Taxi data set that we used for the demo, it's actually available with all of the steps that we discussed on this link. It's documented as a set of blog posts that describe the data science process and how you can apply it to exploring data using Spark. There is also various resources that I mentioned, like the open source components that we used, available on these links. Okay, so with that, we have still 5 minutes for Q&A. Oh, let me see. Okay. Yes?
Do you guys support Zeppelin as well?
The question is, do we support Zeppelin? We are going to release Zeppelin also later this week. So we get requests from customers that some of the customers prefer Jupyter in Python environment, some prefer Zeppelin. So we are bringing back Zeppelin. So now we'll have support for both Zeppelin and Jupyter on HDN side. Yep.
Any support for
MESOS? Any support for MESOS? So at this point, we are Yarn resource manager only cluster. You can certainly install MESOS as a custom component on top of HDN side cluster, but it's not something that we support. Yes?
So you might call me old school, but can you talk a little bit why I should select Spark instead of something like SQLite Warehouse for big data analysts?
The question is why I should select Spark instead of something like SQL Data Warehouse for big data for data analysis? Yeah. So it certainly depends on this other product that you're comparing with. If you are talking specifically about Azure Data Warehouse, it's a great product, and it's very much optimized for interactive data exploration. So all of these BI scenarios that we talked about would be a great fit for Azure Data Warehouse. But it's not designed for machine learning tasks, for example.
Like.
Yeah, so Spark has machine learning library in it, which is a very powerful library that you can use to analyze your data. You can analyze structured to unstructured data. So that is something that Azure Data Warehouse doesn't have. Azure Data Warehouse only has SQL. And in Spark, you can use Python, R, or a variety of libraries that community contributed to process your data in a much broader set of ways than SQL allows you to do. So Azure Data Warehouse is all about interactive BI. Spark is much broader than that. It's about ETL, preparing your raw data for consumption in Azure Data Warehouse. It's about machine learning. It's about unstructured data exploration.
Yeah.
Yes?
One question. I see that SQL magic you were mentioning. So the same thing is also the uSQL, which is also similar. Is that right?
SQL? Sorry.
SQL magic, you are saying here.
Magic? Well.
Oh, Spark magic?
Spark magic.
The select statements, which is being used here.
Oh, yeah. So that is a SQL 92 compatible version of HiSQL that Spark supports. And uSQL supports its own uSQL variant. So what's your question?
OK, so the point is that it is, so each of the software uses a separate kind of SQLs, but maybe it is more similar. So has it not been standards for SQLs using with a different software like Spark and ADL?
I see. Yeah, so there is certainly some diversion of SQL standards. It's not too broad, though. I would say uSQL is the father's departure from the SQL because it brings in C# into it. Mm-hmm. Spark follows fairly standard in the big data world, a dialect of SQL, which is HiveSQL, HiveQL. So it supports In Spark 2.0, they actually extended support to cover SQL 92 standard fully and set of SQL 2003 features as well. So it's it has a fairly broad coverage for industry standard SQL with industry some features from 2003. Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
One second before we move to the next question. Actually, let me conclude the session so we finish recording, and I'll continue answering the questions off stage. Okay? So we are done. Thank you.